This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Out-of-school suspensions are on the rise across the country. Now, that's a troubling statistic if you consider that being suspended just once increases a student's chances of dropping out entirely. So many districts are trying alternatives to suspension, from Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. Jennifer Guerra reports.
We're in the conflict resolution room at Ypsilanti High School. It's quiet, sparse, just a small couch, some chairs, a plant. For decoration, there are a few homemade posters with drawings of shooting stars and signs with slogans like "Together We Can" and "Think Before You Speak." This is where you go if you're on the verge of being suspended.
This room is where we come in with problems and leave with no problems.
That's 17-year-old Darion Reeves. Outside this room, he's a senior. Inside this room, he's a peer mediator. If two students come in with some kind of conflict, it's his job to help them work through it. Everything from problems between boyfriends and girlfriends to dealing with friendships that have gone astray. That's how 16-year-old Morgan ended up here. Morgan, whose last name the school asked us not to use, is a shy, quiet girl, and she seems like the last person who would get into a brawl. But one of her so-called friends started to spread rumors that she was going to beat up Morgan after school one day. So the two girls ended up here, in this room, sitting face-to-face with a peer mediator.
I came in here thinking that things weren't going to change because I knew the person that she was. And when I left, I actually felt that we were going to become friends.
Peer mediation is used more as a prevention tactic to stop conflicts before they get too serious. But if a fight is about to break out or already has, that's when Margaret Rohrer uses something called restorative justice. Rohrer runs the conflict resolution room at the high school.
Restorative practices basically establish a complete paradigm shift from traditional discipline.
With traditional discipline, the focus is on rules and punishment. Break rule X, get punishment Y. With restorative practices, the focus is on harm done and relationships. Let's say somebody starts a fight in the hall, which is definite grounds for suspension. Margaret Rohrer will round up everyone who was harmed by the fight and have them participate in a restorative circle. The student who caused the harm has to listen as one by one he hears how his actions impacted those around him. Now, the student may still be suspended, but
it works because youth are empowered to take responsibility for their own behavior, to be held accountable for their own behavior, and to make it right.
Mara Schiff is a professor at Florida Atlantic University and has worked in the restorative justice field for nearly two decades. She says schools in at least 20 states have started to incorporate restorative justice practices in their school discipline policies. And while there isn't a ton of data on how effective it is, she says what's out there is pretty positive.
We're seeing decreases in suspension and expulsion rates and disciplinary referrals.
At Ypsilanti High School, suspensions have already decreased by about 10% since it started using restorative justice last fall. One 14-year-old freshman at the school is a huge restorative justice fan now, but she wasn't always. Cheyenne admits she has a bit of a temper and has a few suspensions under her belt already. When she and some girlfriends were ready to come to blows, they were marched down to the conflict resolution room.
I think it's easier to talk about it when you have another party involved that doesn't really know what's going on and isn't picking favorites.
Cheyenne says the combination of restorative circles and peer mediation has made her calmer, less quick to judge. And thanks to the conflict resolution room, she hasn't been suspended since. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Guerra.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Now to our series about filling your summer picnic basket with good foods that you can carry around. For a couple of Vermont locavores, a locally sourced picnic doesn't just mean getting supplies from the farmer's market. No, it means finding a natural salad bar at your picnic spot. Maybe even your backyard. Vermont Public Radio, Charlotte Albright tagged along on a wild plant gathering spree.
Nova Kim and Les Hook live on a lush farm between a large lake and the Connecticut River near the Vermont-New Hampshire border. Over the decades, they've become skilled gatherers of edible wild foods, which they sell to high-end restaurants. But on this drizzly day, we're in their own kitchen making dressing for our picnic green salad. With her gray hair and a skinny braid down her back, Nova grinds dried wild ginger root. Les, also long-haired, minces up wild ramps and leeks. The pungent bulbs are no bigger than a pencil eraser.
And you can use them like you would use onion and garlic. It's like a combination of the two, and it can be kind of an intense flavor.
Nova drops about 2 tablespoons of each wild ingredient in a glass pint jar. She adds about 5 tablespoons of lemon juice and a cup of melted coconut oil, which she thinks tastes better with wild greens than heavier olive oil.
This is my kind of mixing. Put it in the jar and shake.
Time to head out the door.
I'd like people to understand they can do this right in their own yard.
Nova doesn't always know exactly what she might find beyond their property, and it's important, she says, to harvest where there has been no chemical spraying. So before leaving the yard, she tucks some common plants, some might call them weeds, in cellophane bags. Nova and Les say plastic ruins delicate pickings.
So I'm going to pick a little bit of stuff right here.
Is that going to be enough? Oh, you're doing the henbit?
Henbit has small, dark, scalloped leaves and tiny purple blossoms along the stalk. Suburban landscapers hate it, but rural gourmets love it.
Our chefs compare it to like a balsamic mint.
With walking sticks and woven basket backpacks, Nova and Les head downhill through a pasture toward a stream. They collect dandelions, violet blossoms, wild sedum, sorrel, and lots of watercress. As storm clouds gather, we settle down on their stream bank for a healthy al fresco lunch.
I'm going to rip this watercress up a little bit. Just to get it a little bit more smaller to eat.
Les tosses the greens in a stainless steel bowl as Nova passes out chopsticks and paper plates.
Everybody got their weapons?
Their wild salads tend to be finely minced. Each crunchy bite of this one tastes a little bitter, a little sweet, and a little sour, especially after you add the tangy ginger root dressing. Les munches slowly and offers his trademark maxim.
Step out your back door and eat forevermore.
If you aren't good at identifying plants or knowing which ones are safe, pack a reliable field guide. Les and Nova rarely pull anything out by the roots unless the tubers are what they need most. And they pick most greens toward the top of a stalk, so the plants will keep growing and supplying them with fresh salad fixings all summer long. For NPR News, I'm Charlotte Albright in eastern Vermont.
Anthony Soprano, a waste management consultant of Essex, New Jersey, died this week. Mr. Soprano was, according to reports that aired for 6 years on HBO, head of the DeMeo crime family, which allegedly ran illicit drugs, untaxed alcohol, illegal sports betting, and other criminal enterprises from the back of an adult entertainment venue called the Bada Bing Club on Route 17 in Lodi. Tony Soprano denied his involvement in organized crime. He said it was a vicious stereotype that slurs waste removal professionals who promote a green, healthy environment. Mr. Soprano's survivors include his wife, Carmela, who loved him but was often exasperated by his frequent absences from family life, a daughter, Meadow, who cherished him but could be embarrassed by her family, and a son, Anthony Jr., who was diffident and rebellious but still relied on his family for support. Mr. Soprano also left several grieving mistresses and their jewelry. He loved animals, including ducks that waddled into his swimming pool. Mr. Soprano's mother once tried to have him killed. That made family gatherings awkward. He also became a public symbol for mental health by seeking professional counseling for his feelings of anxiety and ennui. "This isn't painful," he told a psychiatrist. "Getting shot is painful. Getting stabbed in the ribs is painful. This isn't painful. It's empty. Dead." Mr. Soprano was suspected but never convicted of several murders, including the killing of Sal Big Pussy Bonpensiero, who'd become an FBI informant, Ralphie Soferetto, who Mr. Soprano held responsible for killing his racehorse for insurance money, and Christopher Moltisanti, Mr. Soprano's own nephew, who was addicted to drugs and therefore considered vulnerable to turning state's evidence for the feds. Federal investigators. Mr. Soprano also allegedly ordered the execution of Adriana Laserva, Mr. Moltisanti's girlfriend, because she wanted Christopher to join her in the witness protection program. But Mr. Soprano defended Vito Spadafore from other mobsters who wanted him murdered when his homosexuality was revealed. Tony Soprano was a brutal, loyal, sentimental, cruel, and enthralling character who danced on a high wire between humanity and absurdity. He died this week when James Gandolfini, the actor, who portrayed him so deftly and indelibly on The Sopranos, died at the age of 51. You're listening to NPR News.
I was in a business lounge at an airport in Newark. I look at my phone and I'm moving the buttons, and it was definitely behaving a little strange. Maybe it was a little slow. I ripped the back off the phone. I pulled the battery out. I mean, I got off the network quickly, and I didn't turn the phone back on again until I was out of that airport.
Bill Supernor is the chief technology officer with CoolSpan. That's a mobile phone security company. Snooping and hacking on a lot of people's minds, we reached out to him to find out what you can do to keep your phone secure. First, how vulnerable are our phones?
The BlackBerry is traditionally an enterprise phone, and enterprise wants security, and so that's what they built in from the ground up. On the Apple side, they're striving for a really, really highly controlled and good user experience, and so they've made it very difficult to put in bad apps. And on Android, they're taking a different path, and that is to make the device as open as possible, giving rise, dare I say it, to more creativity. But at the same time, you know, that can leave the door open to creative attacks as well.
So what should you do?
Use a password on your phone. There's a number of different phones that have such a feature where if you fail your password 10 times in a row, it'll either completely lock and disable the phone, or it'll even go so far as to, you know, do the self-destruct and delete all of your data.
So what shouldn't you do?
You should never assume your text messages are secure. Never. It's an easy place to hack. I never send credit card numbers or social security numbers or important private information over SMS.
What about online shopping?
Look for the little lock icon. Look for indications that your connection with the place where you're about to type in your credit card number is in fact secure. Well, eBay has its own app, and all these retailers are coming out with their own app. It's not the web anymore, or it's not a web browser anymore. There is no little lock icon. And also look out for things like Amazon's OneClick, other types of apps that let people make purchases without hitting any buttons beyond buy now.
Bill Supernor, chief technology officer with the mobile security company CoolSpan, with security tips for your phone. And tomorrow, Rachel Martin speaks with NPR's Steve Henn about the ways that parents and kids can protect their privacy online. Plus the latest news on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. We know you're listening to NPR News. President Obama is home for a few days between last week's trip to Europe and next week's tour through Africa. He's meeting an awful lot of foreign leaders. That means a lot of gift exchanges. Now, the president does not personally select these gifts. A staffer does, but there is a well-kept secret at the White House. When this president wants to choose a gift himself for someone in his inner circle, he sets a very high bar. And NPR's Ari Shapiro has the story.
Valerie Jarrett is one of the president's closest friends and advisors. Her West Wing office sits almost exactly above the Oval Office. On one wall hangs a large frame with two historic documents and a handwritten note from the president. The documents reflect half a century of progress on women's rights.
One is a petition for suffrage signed in 1866, and then a resolution by Congress adopting the 19th Amendment, which gives, of course, women the right to vote in 1919. And so nearly over 50 years that it took from the time of the original petition to the time of the resolution.
Last November, Jarrett had a birthday. These documents were the president's gift to her.
And I think the president's message with me is that sometimes time takes time, sometimes change takes time, and that many of the people who signed the original petition may not have made it across the finish line, but that you just have to keep at it. And so I look at it every morning when I come in and I remind myself about why we're here.
People at the White House often see each other more than they see their families. It occasionally feels like a war zone. So coworkers forge tight bonds. And in some cases, those bonds extend all the way to the president.
He really has a knack in giving a present that shows that he really knows who you are, what makes you tick.
This is Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, who used to be White House Chief of Staff. Lew's father was born in Poland and came to the country through Ellis Island. That's always shaped his worldview.
I've had a little statue of the Great Hall of Ellis Island on my desk for decades. My son, when he was in elementary school, brought it back from a school trip.
Last August, Jack Lew walked into the Oval Office and the president had a birthday gift for him, a frisbee-sized green metal disc mounted on a wooden plaque. It now sits on Lew's desk at Treasury.
This is a copper ornamental rosette that originally hung in the Great Hall at Ellis Island. And when Ellis Island was renovated, apparently they couldn't fit all of the rosettes back. And this became available, and it's something that the president gave to me as a birthday gift.
To procure gifts like these takes research, money, and, well, it doesn't hurt to be president of the United States, says Valerie Jarrett.
I said, well, my goodness, how on earth did you get this? And he says, you know, presidents have the ability to get things. So his gift-giving has improved with office.
For people who are less close to the president, he has standard fallback gifts. Several outgoing cabinet members got a key to the White House cabinet room. Another standby is a candid photo of the departing staffer with the president. Then there's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, who received his departure gift on national television. Gibbs delivered his final press briefing on the same day Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak stepped down.
Obviously, Gibbs' departure is not the biggest one today.
President Obama walked into the briefing room unannounced, holding a large picture frame. Inside the frame was a necktie. To understand the significance of the tie, you need to rewind the clock back to 2004. Barack Obama was about to give one of the most important speeches of his career, a keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. Robert Gibbs picks up the story.
I don't think I'm revealing a state secret. We didn't really think much of his taste in ties.
Advisor David Axelrod, no fashion icon himself, decided that Obama's tie was hideous.
And Axelrod grabs the tie that I was about to put on and says, he can wear this one. And I said, no, he can't. I'm about to wear that one. And he says, no, you're not wearing this one. He's wearing this one.
Obama said, no way. I want to wear my own tie. The final decision went to Michelle Obama. And when Barack Obama gave this iconic speech, it was with Robert Gibbs's tie around his neck.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Robert Gibbs never knew what happened to that tie until that day in the White House briefing room 7 years later.
He has not said about anything about this tie all these years. But I have to tell you that I know there's a simmering resentment that he never got it back.
The president handed Gibbs the tie in a frame with a photo of the 2004 DNC speech. So even the president of the United States sometimes falls back on that old cliche gift, a necktie. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, The White House.
The great Nat King Cole had many firsts. He was the first African-American musician to have his own show on network radio, then television. He was also one of the first, if not the first, American artist to record an album in Spanish called Cole Español.
Siempre en su casa presente está el bodeguero y el cha-cha-cha.
It was a huge, kind of unexpected hit. This was 1958, and Latin American music was still relatively unknown in the America of the 1950s. His success with Cole Español was so great, Nat King Cole recorded two more albums in Spanish.
Solamente una vez, amé en la vida.
Now his daughter, the Grammy Award-winning singer Natalie Cole, is following in her father's footsteps. She has a new album, Natalie Cole en Español. It's a collection of much-loved romantic songs in Spanish. Natalie Cole joins us from New York. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Do you remember much of your father recording that first album back in 1958? You were a little girl then.
Yeah, I was pretty young, but because of that first record, Cole Español, we took our first trip, well, my first trip to Mexico. And that was my first time ever traveling outside of the U.S. and really being around people who just adored my dad because of this record. And it was quite an experience for me. So I think I've loved the Hispanic Latin culture ever since because of that one trip.
Why did he record an album in Spanish?
beats me. I mean, you know, Dad was a pioneer. He was fearless. He would try just about anything. And at the time, his manager, Carlos Gastel, was a Cuban gentleman. And he persuaded Dad to look into it. And Dad thought, well, you know, let's give it a shot.
Did he take a Berlitz course before he recorded it?
Not a thing. He learned it all phonetically. And I think that the listening audience really appreciated the fact that an American artist would even attempt to do this music and also include the traditional jewel box of Latin music. And they gave him a lot of kudos, I think, so that they forgave the lack of, let's say, a more refined accent.
I must say, your pronunciation sounds as if you've not only had a Berlitz course or two, but you just came back from 10 years in Valencia.
Well, bless you.
Let's listen to a song. This one is Quizás, Quizás, Quizás.
Siempre que te pregunto que cuando, como y donde, tú siempre me respondes. Quizás, quizás, quizás.
I had so much fun. I think I love the idea of rolling these words off my tongue. And I have to say that I enjoyed myself singing in Spanish more than I sound in English.
Really?
Yeah, I just, there's just something about the whole feel of it is just so different. And I feel like I can put a little more emotion into the phrasing.
Por lo que más tú quieras.
Once you know, of course, what the song is about, then you could have a little more, you know, a little more intense, a little more passion, and a little more sexy. And I just really enjoyed doing this. It was great.
Estás perdiendo el tiempo, pensando, pensando. Por lo que más tú quieras, hasta cuándo, hasta cuándo.
Do you see some commonality between the great Latin jazz standards and U.S. jazz standards?
Absolutely. Number one, memorable melodies. That is what keeps this music going. Any good song, between good lyrics and a good melody, you just can't go wrong. You can hum them, you can remember them, and they stay with you long after.
Was there a time in your life when you, even though certainly loving your father, you wanted to make certain you were making it on your own and kind of avoided the comparison? And
absolutely. Yeah. No question. When I first started to sing, the last thing I wanted to do was sing my dad's music. And ironically, when I was signed to a label, it was Capitol Records. Yeah. Which I thought that they would be like, oh, you got to sing your dad's music. But they
He made Capitol Records.
He certainly did, the house that Nat built. But they did not insist on that. Whereas I went to two other labels, and they said, well, are you going to sing your father's music? And I said, no. And it took 15 years into my career before I felt comfortable and confident enough to even attempt at singing my father's music.
Let's listen to another song, if we could, Acerca de Más.
Yes.
Pero pesa tanto, porque estoy sufriendo. No lo estás viendo, que lo estoy queriendo, sin quererlo tú.
Acerca de Más.
He's still one of the most famous singers in the world, but let me explain. That's your father, the great Nat King Cole.
It was great to do that with him.
How often did you sing when you were young? And I know you lost him when you were young.
Yeah, very young. But, you know, my mom and dad both started influencing us very early with music. I loved singing with Dad, but we didn't sing, like, legit songs. We sang crazy songs. We sang camp songs, and we, you know, and Dad would come up with these really funny, funny songs. We would entertain our parents. Once we saw a Broadway play, we'd memorize the whole thing, and then we'd make them sit on the stairs in front of the living room, and we would go at it. We'd go and get Dad's suits and Mom's gown, and we would start singing Little Abner or South Pacific or The King and I, and it was just so great. So music was always something that, you know, we all just loved.
To hear you and your father sing together, it's just so ineffably touching to hear the two of you singing together.
Oh, thank you.
What's it like for you?
It's really sweet. It's bittersweet. It always will be. I remember the first time that we not really recorded Unforgettable, but the first time that I did it on stage.
Unforgettable it'll forever be known as the album on which you and your father do a duet.
Absolutely. It was very, very difficult, very hard for me, because I'd never had the chance to really spend time working with him. The Unforgettable record was done in tribute to my dad. It was my way of saying goodbye, because when he passed away, I was in school. I was in actually on the East Coast in boarding school when he passed. So,
and he was astonishingly young, just 45.
40, 47.
Unforgettable, that's what you are.
Unforgettable, though near or far.
I believe that, you know, he guides me. Dad led by example. You know, he was not a big talker of, now you got to do this and you got to do that. That was not him. He led by example, and I watched. I was very observant. And I learned so much from my father. And he continues to be my number one inspiration.
Unforgettable. In every way.
Natalie Cole speaking with us from New York. Her new album, Natalie Cole en Español, is out next week. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Scott. You're very kind. It was great talking to you.
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
You can hear songs from Natalie Cole's new album, Natalie Cole Español, at nprmusic.org. This is a great way to begin the day, isn't it? This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.